pretty large meeting room until finally I heard another larger vehicle outside, and I found out later, or I deduced later, I guess, that a truck from Hanoi had arrived. And so I was put into this truck and taken on to Hanoi that night.
And when they took you to Hanoi, is that to the Hanoi Hilton or something?
Yeah, the Vietnamese name for it was Hoa Lo, H-O-A-L-O. Hoa Lo is, I guess is a French-built prison back from the 50s. And the Vietnamese called it Hoa Lo. We called it the Hanoi Hilton. Yeah, it was the big, great, huge prison in the middle of Hanoi. And got there, and there was a airstrike underway. This was at night, in the middle of the night. I got A6s, and they were just—you could hear them all over. SAMs were taking off. You could hear SAMs being fired, and it was an exciting time there for a few minutes. The A6s were very low over Hanoi, I noticed, which I guess was at night. Maybe is okay. The reason we stayed above 3,000 feet because we, in the early days of the war, most people were getting shot down by small arms fire. Just there were so many, everybody had a rifle there, and you get a, in the daytime, if you saw one coming, everybody just shoot up, and the guy would run into it. So that's why we went to a 3,000 foot minimum, I guess. But, anyway, after the airstrike, they took me into the Hilton and put me in what I learned later was called the Knobby Walled Room, which in fact there's a picture of it on the internet if you want to see it, the Knobby Walled Room. But that's where a lot of us had our initial interrogation and initial torture sessions, I guess you'd call it.
And how do you spell that, sir?
Knobby, K-N-O-B-B-Y.
Oh, I see. Knobby room, okay.
Knobby walled room. It was called that because on the walls, I guess for sound suppression, they just had, it was very, very rough. They had made the wall very rough, kind of a little sound cones, I would call them, or they're I think that's what they were trying to do, just because they had a lot of screaming going on there, so they were trying to cut down on the noise outside, I guess. So they had put this room so it had a little, the acoustics were not real good, so the sound would not get out of it. That's just my supposition. I'm not sure about that. But if you want to look at it, I can give you a website where you can take a look at it.
Yes, sir.
Let me. I have to look it up here.
So, sir, when did it hit you that, oh my gosh, I'm going to be here for a long time?
Well, it didn't hit me that. Actually, it didn't hit me for a while. I just thought maybe, you know, the war would have to be over within a year or two, and I think it didn't hit me until I heard about the Vietnamization program that President Nixon started when he became president, 1968. He came down with this way of getting to disengaging us from Vietnam, called the Vietnamization program. And basically what it was we're going to withdraw in stages and turn over all of the defense of South Vietnam to the South Vietnamese. And when I heard that, I knew I was going to be there for a while. So that was, I thought up until then. I know the guy who had briefed us going over this history or political science major, he was very adamant about saying that the war would be over by the election of 68, but he was obviously, I mean, he was wrong. But let's see. It's an anti Perry site, so to tell you what it is, it's about, so you know what you're getting into, but nevertheless, it's got this picture on it. It's www.vietnamexpows.org.
Got it, sir.
Vietnamexpows.org.
And XPOWs ends with an S, dot org.
That's right, yeah.
All one word.
That's right. VietnamexPows, P-O-W-S,
yes, sir.
.org. Yeah, that's VietnamexPows is one word.
I got you, sir. I got it.
Yeah, anyway, that Navi Wall Room is on that. And in fact, there's a poem called the Navi Wall Room, which unfortunately I don't have, but because so many people got hurt in there, I guess they... We had one guy, in fact, he was my sister squadron, and he got shot down, and he wrote a poem called The Navi Walled Room. But anyway, that's where I was taken the first night, and that's where the initial interrogation took place.
And like the teachers in SEER that, you know, initially you'll start off with somebody that's not very hostile, and then the next person that comes in is the hostile person. Is that pretty much how it was, and how did your SEER training was it useful?
Well, it started off with them just asking a question: what's your name, what is your rank, what's your serial number, date of birth, which I gave them. Then they wanted, but he just kept going, okay, what is your squadron? And I said, I'm sorry, I can't tell you anymore my name, rank, serial number, date of birth, and by the Geneva Convention. And he quickly informed me that because we had not declared war, that the Vietnam Conventions did not apply. Because when they signed the Geneva Conventions, which they had, they made a provision that they would only observe it for declared wars. So they pointed out that, as far as they're concerned, the Geneva Conventions had no bearing there. And so then they started asking me again what was my squadron, and I stuck to name, rank, serial number, date of birth, and they just didn't, you know, that was it. Then they turned me over to what some of us called a heavy, who was a big Vietnamese guy, strong, and he just came up and took his fist, fortunately not a gun, but he just knocked me with his fist in the jaw across the room. I mean, he just hit me as hard as he could. And then he proceeded to put me, I guess maybe they asked me again and I refused. And they put me in what's called a rope. We call the rope trick or the pretzel, where you're just tied up in a little ball. A ball of string is stuck in your mouth and just so you don't gag, I think, or maybe to suppress suppress the screams, probably. Never knew exactly what the rationale was. So they first tied a ball of string in your mouth. Anyway, and then they proceeded to put me in this rope, actually wasn't a rope, it actually was an American parachute letdown cord, you know, when you get caught up in a tree, you have this long piece of nylon fiber that's what he used. They may have used other things, but that's what they used on me. It's kind of like a inch and a half wide piece of a strip, nylon strip, probably 15 feet long or 20 feet long. But obviously, I mean, I'd seen one of these things before in a parachute or in a survival kit. So that's what he had to do this little torture session. And they just, they put me in it and left the room. And I don't know, 30 minutes later, they came back, took me out of it, and started asking me these questions again. And once again, I refused, and And so they didn't do anything. They just put me right back into it. This time, I guess they stayed away 2 hours, something like that. And I can't, you know, it was just something where you finally say, well, maybe there's a better way. And what I decided to do, which is basically, I think, what everyone decided to do, is to answer their questions, but just tell them lies. And so that's what I did. And I told them, and when I thought they didn't know the answer already, my aircraft had landed 100 feet from me, and my squadron was right on the tail. So I said, well, I can't, they probably know that. So I the things I knew they knew, I would answer truthfully. And the things they didn't, I didn't think they knew, I'd lie about. And that got me through until they got to my squadron members. And of course, I started lying about that. And the problem was that I'd already had two guys who were gotten shot down before me who had been through the same thing. And they probably told them different lies. So they obviously knew I was lying too. So back into the rope trick again. And whenever they catch you in a lie, you just go back in it. So you had to be really careful. That part of it didn't last a whole lot. It didn't last too long. Your personal history kind of stuff. They were primarily interested in stuff you didn't know. You know, they didn't want to know what targets your ship was hitting tomorrow. And they would not take the "I don't know" for an answer. So, you know, I said "I don't know" three times or something like that, and back in the rope. So it was just their method. So eventually I ended up making up something. I said, well, this is what I would do if I were doing it. I would hit this, you know, a railway bridge, and I would hit that, and that seemed to satisfy them. I guess checking some block. They had to get me to answer that, and once they did, they seemed to be satisfied. So. But I mean, this stuff went on for a day and a half, I guess. Going back over the same thing over and over and over, I guess, to see if they could get different answers out of me. And in and out of the rope. So finally, I guess they were satisfied. I didn't know any more. And then they took me over to the main part of the prison, which was this part, this knobby-walled room, is called the New Guy Village, which, for obvious reasons, that's where they brought all the new guys and initial interrogations and torture sessions. And then I was taken over to what I later learned was called Little Vegas, which was a part of Wallo prison. And Little Vegas was, it basically had big two big rooms, I guess, two big buildings, and some smaller buildings. And I was put in a little cell there by myself for a couple of days. Interesting, I guess. I thought it was interesting, although it was kind of depressing. Well, on our way over there, we had seen some movies about a guy who had gotten captured in Laos. He was flying in a C-130, I guess, and the C-130 got shot down, and he was just a passenger, but he had gotten captured. He was put in a little hut out in the jungle by himself, and he described all the mental things he did to keep his mind from wandering to his bad situation. You know, he did things like alphabetize the all the states, and then take all the state capitals, which he didn't remember to start with, but he eventually worked till he figured them all out, all the state capitals, and alphabetized them, and he arranged them by number of letters in each word, and he just did all these things in his mind over this 6 or 8 months that he was there. He described this. So I said, well, I'll just do what that guy did, and that'll occupy my mind until maybe I, you know, get with somebody else by then. Well, within a day and a half, I'd done every single thing that he had described. I'd gone, alphabetized all these things, and I said, I just remember saying to myself, now what the hell do I do? But it was the underlying biggest problem in being a POW is just keep your mind active off of your problem, you know.
Now, your initial interrogation for a day and a half that you mentioned, was that with no sleep at all?
Basically, yeah, that's right. Yeah, no sleep at all. I did sleep once I got there. They just threw me in this room, this knobby wall room, and left me. And I got a little sleep. The interrogation didn't start till daylight. I guess the officers, the interrogators, didn't come in till daylight. So I was left alone. I got a little sleep from probably 2 a.m. to 6 a.m., something like that. But after that, there was no sleep until they got through.
And then in Little Vegas, that was solitary confinement?
Well, I started off, for the first 2 days, I was solitary confinement. And then they came and got me and put me into a room with three other guys, all of whom were injured to some degree or the other. One guy, another Navy guy, had gotten shot down 2 days before I had. He was in an F-4 backseater, and unfortunately he'd gotten shot down near Haiphong, and I guess they were really mad over there. Anyway, they ran him. Well, I think they were concerned about maybe rescue attempts because he was pretty close to the beach. They took off his boots and then they ran him. He estimated for 10 miles. Mm. And so by the time he got to Hanoi, all of the skin had been torn off the bottom of his feet, so he could not walk. And then another one of my other roommates had a broken leg, broken arm, and the other one had a broken ankle. So they're all cripples basically, except me. I was pretty good. So anywhere we went, I carried the guy with the bad feet for first month, I guess. And he eventually got better, fortunately. But, and then that was in November, early part, December, we were all together. And then in January, mid-January, I got put in solitary confinement for about 6 months. Both the guy with the bad feet and I did. Or making the Vietnamese man.
And so during this period, did the torture and interrogations continue?
Well, not the torture. We didn't get tortured anymore after that initial period for some time. We had what's called attitude checks. We called them attitude checks, or where the Vietnamese, they would, you know, they played propaganda programs all day long. I don't know, from maybe 8 a.m. till 8 p.m. These were things where some of them were Vietnamese American speakers. They would be just Hanoi Hannah. We'd always listen to Hanoi Hannah. But and then that was every evening she came on. But during the day, it was a constant barrage of mostly POWs reading the stuff that they were being forced to read by the Vietnamese over the camp radio. So we had to, you know, we just listened and listened and listened. We basically tune them out, but that's then they would after we listened to this stuff for 10 or 15 days, then they would bring us in for an attitude check and see if it was getting through. I guess at least that was what we assumed they were doing. And I think what they were basically doing was looking for any weakness, on our part, if we started agreeing with them, then I guess they figured they were doing something right, or then they had somebody they could exploit or something. So we're very careful, you know, to never let them think that we were ever being swayed by that stuff. Anyway, but that just went on 12 hours a day for the whole time we were there, basically, at Camp Radio. They, well, at least for the first 2 or 3 years, I guess that eventually it didn't. The whole time we were in Little Vegas, it went on. I don't remember exactly when. I don't think later on they bothered to do that. But I forgot what your question was.
Yes, sir. I was going to ask, did you know of other prisoners that were at the prison, or did you just know about the three individuals that you had contact with?
Well, we knew there were other prisoners. We could, you know, we could see them as they came out to get their food. During the day, they would be. We could peek through the cracks in the door and see them, and we could hear them next door on either side. And you know, strangely, we thought it strange at the time. We would whisper out the window and try to tell them our names and who were they, and they said, shh, you know, they didn't want us to talk. And unbeknownst to us, there had been this huge purge, was what we called them, back in the summer of 67, where they just, I guess, beat the crap out of these guys because they caught some of them communicating. And we were strictly forbidden to communicate between rooms or among others. We're strictly forbidden to speak so loud that we could be heard outside our rooms. We had these camp regulations, they call them, posted on all the doors. And we had all these rules that you couldn't, that you're not supposed to, all the things we weren't supposed to do. And communicating was the biggest taboo of all. So they had just, a lot of people just been going through the ringer because they'd been caught communicating. And so these guys were literally, I guess they thought we were naive, and we were. But they had other methods of communicating we just didn't know about. And so there was these new guys across this way, which they turned out they were willing to communicate because they hadn't been through this. They were shot down about the same time we were. So when we went out, we whispered to them a little. They were across the hall from us, and they had whispered a little bit. And we were able on a couple of occasions to slip a note under their door and tell them who we were. And so, but for the most part, there was no communications with anybody other than that room.
But you could talk to the individual that was sharing your cell.
Yeah, as long as they couldn't hear you outside, they didn't care about that.
I see. And how did the prison guards treat you, other than the ones that tortured you?
Well, decently, most of them. We didn't have a lot of contact with them, except they opened the door 2-3 times a day for sure, and then sometimes we got to also go out and wash, and then sometimes you'll be called out for a quiz or an attitude check. So the 3 times were in the morning. We would go empty our slop bucket, our toilet, which was just a peck bucket that we sat on, basically, and we'd go empty that in the latrine, and then there was a morning meal that we ate probably in the neighborhood of 10 o'clock, something like that, 9 or 10 o'clock, so they'd have to open the door for that. And then sometimes maybe once a week, we would go out and wash, which was, there was a wash house outside, so we'd go out and wash. And then in the evening meal, we would, they'd have to open up the door. We'd usually eat and probably 5 o'clock in the afternoon. So we had two meals a day.
And what did the meal consist of most of the time?
Well, it depended on the season. Probably the single most common meal was a bowl of pumpkin soup and a plate of pumpkin that was taken from the pumpkin soup and a piece of French bread. That was kind of the staple. Once in a while, we would have a bowl of green soup and a bowl of greens or a plate of greens that were taken from the green soup, and then a piece of French bread. The French bread was, I guess, our staple. We always had that. Later on, when we got out to Santé, I guess we were out in the farm country, and there, once in a while, we would have black-eyed peas, which was probably the best meal we ever got there. We would have, once in a while, cabbage in the wintertime. And once in a while, we would have bean curd or whatever that's called, tofu. We call it tofu. We call it bean curd there, but I guess the official name was tofu. But that was a good meal, too. And then, oddly enough, about once every 3 weeks, we'd have a bowl of sugar. I think they had someone told them that Americans need sugar or something. So that was our meal, just a bowl of sugar. You know. So we try to save that, you know, to spread it out because and eat it with our bread. But that was it. I don't think we. Only time we had anything different than any of that was either a special occasion like Tet or Ho Chi Minh's birthday. We'd have a little bit special meal, usually a little bit better meal. Or when we moved up on the Chinese border, which was the last camp I was in last place I lived before getting released, basically. There was a camp up there, we think, you know, we thought we were right across the creek from China. And we were close. If it wasn't that close, it was very close. And there we had quite a bit of rice. Once in a while in Hanoi we had rice, but very, very rare. Maybe once a month, something like that. Also, I should mention that once a week, we'd get a spoonful of liverwurst, Russian liverwurst. Then on very rare occasions, we'd get maybe a fish head in our soup. It was sparse, but it was, I think, probably a healthy diet overall. Or in the early years, you know, some people didn't get enough vitamins, and they got beriberi. But after I got there, I think the meals were sufficient to avoid beriberi, probably.
Now, did you suffer from dysentery or any other types of disease like that?
Oh, yeah. Dysentery was fairly common. Pretty frequent. I wouldn't call it dysentery, but maybe wasn't that bad, but diarrhea quite a bit. And a dysentery occasionally, I suppose, would be that bad. But for the most part, I was pretty disease-free, though. Once in a while, I'd get a cold, but rarely, which was kind of strange because the winter there got pretty chilly. Especially up on the Chinese border there, we actually saw ice a couple of times up there. But all the windows, you know, none of the windows ever had anything over them, so they were always, we were always exposed to the outside air. Whatever the temperature was outside, that's what it was inside, basically.
Now, did they give you warm clothing in the winter?
Well, we had the same clothing all the time. We had two pairs of long pants, one pair of long pants, one pair of long shirt, one long shirt, two pair of shorts, and two short shirts. I think that was their clothing, which counted, no underwear, that counted as your underwear, basically. They were black shorts, you know, kind of like we would, kind of like a bathing suit we'd wear for a bathing suit, or jogging shorts. And we had a pair of shoes, or flip-flops, we all called Ho Chi Minhers. And we had, each of us had two blankets. And each of us had a rice mat to sleep on. Each of us had a liter water jug. Each of us had a cup. Each of us had a toothbrush. Each of us had a bar of soap and toothpaste.
Now, how often did they let you bathe?
It depended on their water situation, but I would say on the average, I guess, over the entire time I was there, maybe two times a week.
No, I see.
Sometimes it was less than that because they, oddly enough to me, but they had real water problems up there. I guess getting water, even though the Red River ran right through Illinois, they didn't have any water. And maybe they didn't have any water they wanted us bathing in, I don't know. But you could turn the speakers on a lot of times and there were no water would come out of it. I guess they just didn't have, and it may be because of the bombing, perhaps they were bombing the water plants or something. I don't know why, but we didn't, water was not very plentiful there. Of course, in drinking water, all that had to be boiled, so water was a very precious commodity there for them.
I see. Now, as far as communication, you mentioned you'd whisper and all that. Now, did you utilize the tap code?
Oh, yeah. Well, once we learned it, we didn't know it, of course, when we first got shot down, so it took me 6 months to find out about it. I found out about it in solitary when I was in solitary confinement, kind of a isolated cell, and another guy got put back there who was in there about 2 years longer than I had, and he taught it to me. So we eventually learned how to communicate with the tap code, yeah.
And was it pretty second nature to where you could tap without even thinking?
Yeah. In fact, it's taken me 15 years to quit tapping or going around tapping all the time. I used to be in the bed with my wife, and I'd be tapping on her shoulder and just absentmindedly, I'd just be thinking something, and I'd be tapping it out as I was thinking it. And so I finally almost got broken myself of that.
I see. And now how about the code of conduct? Did it provide enough guidance for you all?
No, I don't think it did. It was very depressing, I guess, when you learned you couldn't, that you had given them more than name, rank, date, serial number, and date of birth. I think we all came to believe that the code of conduct should be a little more flexible than that. That was, I think, most of our understanding. That's what we were supposed to give. That was only what we were supposed to give, was those four things. And none of us, to my knowledge, were able to stick to that. So we felt that maybe the code of conduct should, well, what we did, basically, our leaders, recognizing that no one could the code of conduct was a little too not flexible enough. We made up a appendix to the code of conduct, you might say. Anyway, we made up our own rules, or the SRO did, and where we it kind of supplemented the code of conduct. It recognized that we could not stick to strictly name, rank, serial number, date of birth. So it's a good theoretical guideline, and if you're people who capture you will go for the Geneva Conventions or recognize them, then yeah, it'd probably be great. Great guidance. In our situation, it was not flexible enough. So we wanted to, you know, keep our sanity about us, and yet we didn't. We felt, for example, that to resist giving them anything but date, rank, name, rank, date of birth, serial number until you had lost your mental faculties, which happened in a few cases, was probably more detrimental to the United States than saying, okay, I've gone to my limit, and then when you get there, before you go past it, you give them enough to keep them to get you out of that situation. And, you know, you just lie, basically. You just make up something. And that's why kind of the way we did it later on, once we got organized, we would never give them anything free, but if they tortured us for, you know, later on when they had more time, they weren't interested in immediate military information like they were when we were first shot down. They had more time, and they didn't use a rope there. They used either you kneeling or more commonly probably is a stool. They would just put you on a stool and sit you there. You would sit there for until you decided to do what they wanted, which was typically write something. You know, write a letter to Senator Fulbright, for example, who was chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. So, and they didn't care if it took 2 days or 2 months, you know, but you just sat there until you wrote something. And so our rules, at least from our SRO at Sante, was to resist until you couldn't resist anymore, but don't resist to the point that you lose your mental faculties and then end up giving them more than you would otherwise. So we typically, you know, we kind of had a, you know, didn't have guidelines, but people would stay on a stool 24 hours a day for, you know, maybe a week or 10 days, and then they would give in and say, okay, I can't take this anymore, and before they totally went crazy and gave them whatever they wanted, and then they would try to keep their, you know, screw up whatever they were writing, so nobody who ever read it would ever believe it was given voluntarily. But
now, did you know if a POW chain of command, and did you know who your SRO was?
Well, it took a while before we knew that. When I got back in the solitary confinement room with all by myself, and then this guy came back, and he had been put back there because he had some sort of skin disorder, so they didn't want him spreading it around, I think. But anyway, because we were kind of isolated back there, we were able to communicate quite a bit, and he taught me the TAP code, and he basically told me who the SRO was, and I didn't know anybody's name except my ex-roommates, but yeah, it became apparent that the the camp organization there at Little Vegas was very very sophisticated. The SRO was known. It was Commander Stockdale, as I recall, at the time, and there were actually four full colonels there also, none of whom chose to assume the SRO ship. So for reasons I'm not quite sure, but they were kind of isolated, so it had been difficult. So, but Commander Stockdale, I guess, was the SRO there, although we really never had any communication with him, not in my room, but he put out, you know, all the word on what not to do and what to do and that kind of stuff.
Did you ever meet Admiral Stockdale later on, or?
Not until after the war.
I see.
Well, I beg your pardon. After the war. I didn't meet him until after the war.
And while you were a POW, did you get mail or any care packages?
I got mail, I got a few pieces of mail from my wife. I got the first one, I guess, I think at Christmas, I got a letter from my wife, and I was allowed to write to her at Christmas, and she got it the following September, it turned out. Care packages, later on we started getting care packages, but that in, after Ho Chi Minh died, he died in 69, as I recall, September 69. After that, our treatment improved pretty dramatically, actually, compared to what it was. The torture ceased, as far as I knew. We started getting a few care packages from home, and some of us, not everyone, some wives refused to send them, I later learned. They were afraid they were being used for propaganda, I think. Once in a while we get one, something from home.
Now, did you know that Ho Chi Minh had died?
Oh, yeah. It was very obvious when he died. The whole country was, yeah, that was always on the radio. You know, you could tell something bad. I think the guards told us that Ho Chi Minh had died.
And how about the treatment towards you all? Did it change after the Tet Offensive and Linebacker 2?
No, I never noticed any change from either of those two events. The only thing, change in treatment seemed to be associated with Ho Chi Minh's death. After he died, when he died, we had two quiz, actually had three quiz rooms at Santé's where I was at that time, and they were all three filled with people being tortured to write letters to various congressmen and so forth. And then when he died, within 3 or 4 days, they were all clear, and no one ever, that never happened to anyone again. So I've always associated with his death that he was the one probably causing the torture to start with, or he wasn't probably causing torture. He was the one, he was just saying, I want letters from these POWs to be sent back home saying the war is wrong, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yes, sir. And now, why did they move you from prison to prison?
Well, they just basically filled Little Vegas up. Little Vegas got full, and so they moved all of us. I shouldn't say all of us, all the junior guys. from Little Vegas out to Sante. So depending on when you got there, the guys who had been there, say, a year and a half before us, they moved them out to a camp called the Zoo. So they just, whenever they got Little Vegas filled up, they had opened a new camp and move them out, and all the new guys were put in Little Vegas again. So and just a space thing, I think.
I see. And was the treatment better at the other prisons as compared to Hallow?
Wallow? No, I wouldn't say it's better. In fact, no, it is very similar. Had a little better food out there, I think, because we were out in the country, and maybe the, you know, we had some black-eyed peas out there. We'd never had that in Hanoi. So it was about the same. The treatment was pretty much the same.
I see. And so what were the toughest and the loneliest of times for you?
The solitary confinement by far was the hardest time I had there. I spent 6 months from January until June in or July in solitary confinement in 1968. And back in that ice, it was, and I was not just in solitary, I was isolated also. I was back in a little corner of the prison in a little 3x8 cell that, you know, I couldn't even walk in. In order to walk, I had to walk on my bed. That was all it was, basically, the bed. And I was in, you know, I was in leg irons for a month while I was there, in handcuffs and blindfolded. I was being punished for thinking about escaping. At least that was their accusation. So anyway, that was hard. That was when you had to physically make yourself think about something other than your family.